Welcome to Your Health. I'm Ann Goldin, and this week we're going to talk about the immune system, the good, the bad, and when things go sideways, what to do. My guest is Dr. Tracy Erfling. She's a naturopathic physician and practices in Astoria. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's talk about the immune system. Let's start out with talking about what is the immune system. People talk about, you know, you need to work on my immune system. My immune system is shot. My immune system is good. What are we talking about?
Well, it's a fairly extensive network of cells that circulate between the blood, the, you know, venous and arterial systems, and the lymphatic system, which is sort of a partner to our cardiovascular system, in that it runs mostly in the trunk, but you know, as far as like the major epicenters of nodes, like I think everybody is connected to the idea that they have lymph nodes in their armpits, and they have lymph nodes around their neck. They also have a lot of lymph nodes in their groin, and then there's quite a network also of lymph nodes along the spinal column, where, you know, the major aorta runs in the body. So between these two sort of running systems, there are different blood cells that circulate, identify, attack. I mean, you know, the nuances of the immune system are probably even beyond my comprehension at times, but it is a fabulous working part of the body. And I think a very under recognized part of the immune system is our gastrointestinal tract. They say that about 60% of our immune system is housed in the gastrointestinal tract, and a large part of that is that whole probiotic element, or the good gut flora element that participates in our small intestine and colon. So I think just looking at the way that all those systems interact is how we see the immune system.
And so when someone's immune system is not working or is fragile, mm-hmm. they get sick a lot.
Mm-hmm.
What would lead them to?
What kind of things are we looking at there?
Yeah.
You know, when I'm asking people about their immune system, I'm concerned just as much with someone that gets sick a lot as someone that never gets sick. You know, I think that we feel good about the fact that, you know, we don't get beaten down by colds and flus, but it's also really important for the immune system to understand how to mount a response to things. So when it doesn't really know how to do that, then I, you know, think, well, there's maybe some stimulation that could occur here too to really strengthen the body. Another thing I think about quite a bit when people aren't getting sick very often is their adrenal function. It sounds sort of unrelated, but of course everything's related.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the body's not able to respond to a stressor like a bacteria or a virus very well, meaning that either they're not mounting a response, or maybe they're mounting too much response, either end of the spectrum, I often will take a look at those adrenal glands too, once we get past sort of the immediate illness.
Mm-hmm. I think people think of the adrenals as a stress.
Right. But, you know, getting sick and dealing with sort of foreign invasion is a stress for the body.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
So, you know, not only are we looking at bacterial and viral infections as far as immune system, but we're also looking at things that just our body mounts onto itself. So those are things like allergies, whether that's an environmental or inhaled allergy or a food allergy. Certainly autoimmune conditions are another thing that I would probably lump into that that type of category as far as immune system.
And then insults. So with autoimmune problems, well, allergies are an autoimmune problem.
Allergies kind of are an autoimmune problem. It's sort of like a response gone awry, like it's just over responding to things. So we need to figure out a way to make the system sort of calm down a little bit and respond more appropriately. And a lot of times that's, you know, a lot of times that's healing in the gastrointestinal tract. Honestly, when I'm looking at allergies, I'm also paying very close attention to what people's digestive symptoms are because they're so interwoven.
Now, for you and I, those are accepted ways of thinking. And mm-hmm. But out in the population at large, that is not at all what people are thinking about when they're thinking about allergies. They're thinking about suppression of symptoms.
They are, yeah.
And it doesn't really go beyond that.
Nope.
Except possibly giving maybe some injections of a substance to
try to build up sort of your tolerance.
Right.
Is sort of the notion, yeah. And then also there's a lot of corticosteroid use to try to just shut off an immune response, which, you know, it definitely has its moments of efficacy, but it's not the message we really want the body to be getting. We really want the body to just be responding more appropriately rather than just not responding at all.
Well, with regard to allergies, most people don't even have it in their thinking that an allergy can be eliminated, that it can be overcome. It's just something to be suppressed and managed.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think dealing with the, you know, strengthening the immune system, making the gut happy,
mm-hmm.
usually gets rid of or significantly reduces.
Yes, significantly. And I think in the area of food allergies, what I see with people a lot is that they'll identify that a food or a group of foods is an issue and then just feel like, okay, I just can't ever eat those foods again. And there definitely are some issues or some conditions where that is the truth. But I think if we don't look at the idea of helping the body to repair and rejuvenate so that it can tolerate foods that I think are meant to be eaten, then we're really doing the body a disservice by just pulling out a food group entirely. Now, you know, that's not to say, like I said, there's some conditions, like I'm just going to pull celiac out as something that, you know, someone has true celiac disease, they're not going to be able to eat gluten. I don't, you know, there's no magical remedy out there that fixes that.
Right. The fix is you take it out.
Right. But I think for maybe more subtle food allergies, like let's say that someone has, you know, maybe more of a dairy intolerance, like when they eat a lot of dairy, they have maybe some gastrointestinal symptoms. But you know, with some of the type of testing that I run with patients, I can kind of gradate that a little bit so I can see, wow, that's a really strong response as opposed to, oh, that's a really, you know, mediocre response. And then maybe we can introduce a food like that, you know, a couple times a week. Definitely can't be eaten three times a day, every day. But if it's eaten in more moderation, it seems to be tolerated just fine. So I think that there's a lot of nuances on how to deal with, especially food allergy. Environmental allergies are a little trickier as far as, you know, your control over the exposure. But I think there's definitely a way to heal those things too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Maybe we should differentiate between other kinds of infections.
Sure. I think when people get, this is the time of year when people are starting to get a little more sort of the cold flu thing going on. And people wonder about, you know, I get a lot more calls wondering about, well, you know, is it time to take antibiotics? And, you know, I'm feeling really sick. Should we maybe think about antibiotics? And, you know, certainly we can always keep that in the back of the mind. But a bacterial versus a viral infection has some sort of telltale signs, I think. So usually with a bacterial infection, people get pretty sick pretty fast. And if your body does mount a good response, then you'll get a fairly significant fever and feel really tired and, you know, maybe not feel much of an appetite, as opposed to a viral infection might be more of a sort of a dragging, fatigued, and certainly some low grade fever. But I tend to not see quite as an overwhelming sort of reaction as a bacterial infection. So that's one thing that we're paying attention to and thinking about how to deal with treating the problem.
Mm-hmm. And of course, this subject cannot pass without the acknowledgement of the rampant use of antibiotics mm-hmm. for viral infections, mm-hmm. which doesn't do anything
right.
for them.
Right. And I think, you know, I don't think this is a brain science to anybody that, you know, if you're not dealing with a bacteria and you're giving an antibiotic, and it's, I think there is some placebo effect that happens there, because sometimes people do really feel like they get better on antibiotics regardless of whether they have an actual bacterial infection or not.
But I think they were actually already getting better.
They were actually already getting better. Yeah.
Right. Because a lot of times when people get to the point where they've reached their tolerance for whatever's wrong with them, mm-hmm. it's right at the breaking point when they're starting to get well anyway, mm-hmm. but they want to go to the doctor because they're just uncomfortable with where their symptoms are.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, especially when I'm dealing with like moms and kids, I always say, you know, mom or dad, you are the ultimate sort of keeper of where this therapy is going to go. If you are reaching a point of discomfort and feeling like you're unable to, you know, either monitor the situation or feel comfortable with where the situation is going, then you make the shots. You call the shots. But, you know, I'm usually pretty comfortable letting the body kind of figure it out, definitely giving support so that it can do it correctly and giving some warning signals about things to pay attention to if things are going wrong. But
well, right, if you have an exceptionally high fever.
Yeah, so maybe let's talk about fevers a little bit, because I think that that's a really important response of the immune system. And I think that sort of modern medicine has taught us that it's a bad thing, that we shouldn't be having fevers. But really, obviously, it's there for a reason. And there's no better way for the body to especially fight, I'm going to say, bacteria, which is why we get such a mounted response with bacteria, than to kind of burn it off. You know, that's the system that was developed in the body to get rid of an organism.
Right. You heat them up and they die.
Yeah. They just can't tolerate, you know, a lot of different temperature
variation.
So what
do we do? We want to put a fever reducer in. Let's take some acetaminophen.
Right. And I think, you know, there's definitely times when kids are really cranky and they're not sleeping and, you know, that's wearing on you as much as them. And, you know, obviously there's a time to intervene. But if you can, you know, tolerate letting a fever go. And, you know, I usually say that a fever up to 105 is a pretty healthy response. Certainly a fever that goes over 105, you start getting, especially with kids, you start getting that chance of those febrile seizures, the seizures, which are harmless. I mean, they're not fun. I've never seen one. I'm sure they're not fun to watch or, you know, have your child go through, but they won't cause any kind of permanent damage. But the thing that I'm looking for most with fever is just watching for dehydration. So you want to make sure that the kiddos or whoever has the high fever is definitely getting plenty of fluids, that they're still able to, you know, urinate fairly regularly, that they're, if they're infants, that they're still tearing, like if they cry, if they still produce tears. And then another classic sign to look for, especially maybe in elderly people, is tenting of the skin. So if you pull on the back of your hand, if the skin doesn't retract back to its normal surface quickly, then that might be a sign that there is some dehydration. Anne's pondering her retraction right now.
I think I need to drink more than coffee this morning.
Maybe that's the problem.
And what about eating?
You know, yeah, so a lot of
like starve a fever,
right? Mm. Yeah, whatever. So, I mean, I think that if you know, especially with kids, a lot of times kids don't have, or people in general don't have appetites when they're sick, and I think that's fine. It's the body's way of saying, you know, I need a rest from the digestive process, which takes a lot of energy to focus elsewhere and really make the body feel better. So, you know, in general, when we get sick, I think that it just our culture's sort of modality is to say, well, we just have to push through and, you know, keep going and, you know, persevere. But really, you need to take a break and rest and, you know, give your body time to really get through the process and nourish it. You know, it's kind of a treat to get to stay home and be sick and pamper yourself with movies or whatever you do, hot baths or
and hot tea.
Yeah, and hot tea. So I think really, you know, celebrate the fact that your body can mount a good response and that your body is learning something new and allow it to go there.
We're back. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Your Health. I'm Anne Goldin, and I'm with Dr. Tracy Erfling. She's a naturopathic physician, the practice in Astoria. And so when people are tenting or they're dehydrated, they've either been throwing up, had diarrhea, or just they've just had a high fever and they're dehydrated, you have a formula that
I
you
do,
recommend.
And you know, I guess I just want to say one caveat: if the dehydration seems really severe, if there's the fever's been high and there's a lot of lethargy and they seem dehydrated, that might be a time to actually seek out some medical attention, because sometimes people won't take in enough fluids by mouth, and they might need some intravenous intervention.
Okay,
and so don't feel afraid to utilize those, because that is one of the great things we have with our skills of modern medicine is that
right, ability. And it's quick, and you start to feel better.
Yes,
you know, definitely. Within an hour.
But I think just, you know, kind of as the response is mounting, as maybe the fever is mounting, I have a great little electrolyte that's super easy from your kitchen formula. Mm-hmm. That's a teaspoon of salt, and this is into two quarts of water. A teaspoon of salt, a teaspoon of baking soda, a teaspoon of sugar, or if you have a child that's not under a year of age, you can do 2 teaspoons of honey. So just an easy little formula into 2 quarts of water that can just have the basic electrolyte combination to keep you hydrated.
And then how much of that water would you, that's 2 quarts.
Yeah.
Is quite a bit.
That's quite a bit. Yeah. So, you know, for an adult, I don't think that's unreasonable, but for an infant or a child, you know, you probably wouldn't get that whole 2 quarts, and maybe you drink half that. But that's the ratio of the amount of material to water that's appropriate.
Okay, we had a caller who wanted us to talk about alcohol, beer and wine, and their impact on the immune system.
Well, I think that when you're dealing with an illness, that anytime you're dealing with any kind of illness, I tell people to watch their sugars, and alcohol definitely fits into that category. So I think it does have the potential to kind of dampen the function of the immune system if you're intaking sugars of any kind, including alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that being said, as far as like overall kind of support, you know, wine has some really amazing, especially red wine, has some really amazing bioflavonoids in it. So that is one thing that really could promote, especially some sort of stability of the vascular walls, and therefore kind of better fluid exchange and so forth. So there's potential for, you know, red wine and you know.
Well, we're not talking about a bottle at a meal.
No.
Yeah, a glass.
It's a moderate.
Maybe two
it's
glasses.
A moderation thing.
Right, moderation. Right. I think 4 ounces for women and maybe 6 or 8 for men.
Oh, that sounds about right.
Okay.
I'm not up on my total ounceage there.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, vaccines. This is a huge topic and a very touchy topic.
Mm-hmm. And controversial in a lot of circles.
Yes, yes. And so I really just want to talk about a couple things. One is that vaccines in general are not terribly studied before they're put out to the general population. When they are studied, they're only studied for adults. And the studies really just see, is the vaccine that we've created going to affect the thing we want it to affect? So whether that's for chickenpox virus or measles or, you know, any of the classic ones. The flu vaccine is not, you know, they don't know what flu strain is going to come around, what viral flu strain is going to come around.
Well,
for
plus
the year.
It's a very adaptable organism.
Absolutely.
And it's always changing.
Absolutely. So they kind of go through and guess to mate. I'm sure they use some sort of system that seems logical, but they guess basically. They say, okay, well, I think it's going to be this one. And to date, they have not really ever gotten that correct. They've never picked the strain that has seemed to be the most virulent for the year. So another thing along with the safety element with vaccines is that since they're not very heavily studied prior to putting them out to the general population, they rely on a system, a vaccine reporting system. It's called VARS, and it's an adverse effect reporting system. I can't remember what the exact acronym is, but they rely upon people and physicians to report adverse effects, and that's how they get information about the efficacy or the safety and sort of adverse effects.
And,
of vaccines.
And how do doctors report this?
There's a phone number. If you're an administrator of vaccines, there's a system of either internet or phone numbers to call.
Okay,
and you should as a patient receiving a vaccine, you should always get that same information so that you can self-report.
Okay, but we know in reality, people don't,
right,
and doctors don't.
Right. I think, you know, when there's a fairly severe adverse effect, you know, if someone were to have a seizure or go paralyzed or something, certainly that gets. But I think, you know, the redness or that general sort of illness, you know, those kind of symptoms don't, I think, get very underreported. And it would be interesting to know if people actually did report all those, how much more sort of adversity there would be to, you know, receiving a vaccine.
Well, right. If nobody's, if very few adverse effects are being reported, then it's very easy for the manufacturers to say, look how safe it is, look
right,
how event-free it is, when it may not be. But
right,
we don't know if nobody, just like reporting rape, if nobody reports,
right,
then we say, see, nobody's getting raped.
Right. So I think it's just something to be aware of. I'm not hanging my hat on whether vaccines are good or bad on this particular program, but I think that there's a lot of issues with them and that people should be aware of how they can become involved to learn more or to kind of improve the efficacy and safety of
mm-hmm.
these.
Well, I have many, many people who tell me that as soon as they got a flu vaccine, you know, they got flu.
Sick, yeah.
And I don't know if it's a coincidence or if they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't. So, there's no way to measure that.
Let's move on to other things.
Okay, fine.
Because I think that that's another problem with vaccines is that that's all that, you know, the basic sort of health organizations, that's all they really promote. They don't promote, you know, resting and eating well and getting fluids. I mean, they promote washing hands and staying home if you're sick. Actually, they do kind of say that. But I think there's so many other great things we could be promoting people to do. And I feel sorry that those aren't out there as readily as vaccines.
And they are today.
So there's just a few basic nutrients that I think about. There's obviously vitamin D, which probably we've belabored in this area more than a lot of others because we're so deficient here. There's vitamin C. I think people
are
pretty
aware
of that.
Do you want to give some recommendations
sure.
of amounts?
I'm usually telling patients, and it's based on whether or not I've actually tested them or not, if I've tested them and they're low, then I'm saying that we're going to maybe do like 2,000 to 4,000 IUs through the winter. If they haven't been tested, my basic recommendation is just to do about, you know, 1,000 to 2,000. And then vitamin C, I usually tell people just to kind of take as much as they can tolerate, mm-hmm. Especially when they're sick. Zinc is another really amazing mineral that helps to improve immune function. It can be slightly nauseating for people. So sometimes I advise them to take that before bed so they kind of just sleep through that part. Essential fatty acids are really important because they help these nutrients actually access the cells.
Give examples.
So they are part of how the actual cell membrane is made up, and if they are more readily available, the cell can more easily take up nutrients. It kind of can flow between in and out of the cell.
Okay, what foods do they come in?
So a fish,
yeah,
flax oil, or you know, as far as supplement wise, but certainly nuts and seeds are fairly rich in essential fatty acids. If you have grass-fed meat, that they have a good source of essential fatty acids. And then, you know, a lot of vegetables, fruits and vegetables have lower levels, but definitely have them too.
Another plug for fruits and vegetables.
You can't get enough of those things.
No, you can't get enough. Or you can't get too much anyway.
Right, right. And then probiotics would be another thing that I would definitely promote people doing, especially around this time of year. So, and those can be found in supplement form, obviously. So we're talking about Acidophilus, Lactobacillus. Actually, Bifidobacterium is another one that I've been reading a lot more about and its importance in the immune function. And then foods that we think about for probiotic content is yogurt. Now, if you have a lot of dairy issues, yogurt might not be your best option.
You know, a lot of people think that's where that the first thought when you say probiotics.
Yep.
And, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm seeing more and more people who should not be having at least cow products.
I've been seeing yogurt comes up really high on a lot of my food allergy tests, actually, and especially with kids. I think that yogurt's a really popular food for kids, which, you know, I don't think that's horrible, but I think it's mounting more of a response than we think in a negative way.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, but it is a source. And then there's also lots of fermented soy products like miso mm-hmm. and tempeh. You know, miso is like the most amazing sort of chicken soup for the immune system. It's really chock full of nutrients and probiotics.
And it takes 2 seconds to make a lovely soup. I mean, you boil water, you put in a little tofu, some veggies, throw the miso in at the end, stir, and
it's kind of salty. So, you know, if you're feeling kind of nauseated or not so settled in the tummy area, that sometimes can be useful for people. Mm-hmm. So it's a great food. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, any kind of fermented sauerkraut or kimchi, you know, maybe these are not things you want to eat when you're sick, but just in general to get a probiotic source from food.
Well, some people love that hot of kimchi when they're sick. They feel like it like burns out the sick.
Right. So those are some good nutrients and foods to think about.
They are really easy to make. Kimchi is simple. Sauerkraut is easy. Yeah. Anybody can do it, especially in the summer when your cabbage is drowned or zucchini or whatever. It's very easy to make. We have a big jar of it in the refrigerator.
Good for you guys.
Yeah, it was simple.
Okay, so then a few other remedies I really like for immune system stuff are... one is my warming socks treatment. All my patients are kind of giggling right now because I love talking about the warming socks. So basically, this is a hydrotherapy technique. So we're using kind of the powers of hot and cold to move blood. And this is great for especially like when you have upper respiratory congestion or sinus congestion. So you take a pair of thin cotton socks and you get them wet in cold water, as cold as you can tolerate. For some people, that's going to be kind of lukewarm, and that's fine. We've got to start where we can start. And you wring that out, so they're not dripping, soaking wet. Put them on your feet. Put on top of that, a thick wool sock, something that's going to keep the moisture in, and then sleep with those on. And just really helps to kind of keep the fluids moving in the both lymph system and the cardiovascular system, and really pulls congestion out of the head. The one caveat is that if you are chilled, so if you're kind of in a really feverish, chilled state, you need to take a really hot bath or get in a really hot, or maybe skip it that night, because it could potentially worsen something if you put them on cold feet, basically. You can do a similar thing to your throat for sore throats.
Would you do the warm socks every night?
You know, it's really awesome for kids, especially when they're not sleeping well because of congestion. And yeah, I would probably have people do it kind of nightly through the worst of it. And then...
When they're sick.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Not when they're well.
No, yeah. This is a when you're sick treatment for sure.
Okay.
And then just in general, when you're sick, a lot of people have immune herb therapies that they have on their shelf. And I think they're great, but people tend to really underdose with them. So when you're using herbs, it's not like taking a medication that you just take once or twice a day. This is something that really needs to be in your body regularly throughout your illness.
Like echinacea.
Yeah, like echinacea.
Every few hours.
Yeah, so you should be taking that immune product every few hours. Like I usually say, you know, with capsules, I say, you know, 2 to 4 every 2 to 4 hours. Mm-hmm. Or with a tincture, you know, you do a couple squirts every couple hours. And really, you know, continually remind the body throughout the day to keep on task. Mm-hmm. I think that they work terrifically if you use them well. And if you don't, you know, if you're underdosing, you're not going to get as much of a response.
30 seconds.
So, okay.
Other ones?
I guess then one last remedy I like, especially for diarrhea, is rice water. And so basically you're making rice just like you normally would, but you only boil it for a couple minutes and then you throw out the rice and you keep the water and drink the water. It's rich with starches that help kind of bind up the stuff in your bowels and help you.
Probably cool it down before you drink
it. Well, absolutely. Yes. Okay. Don't drink boiling hot rice water.
Wow. Well, that's a lot of stuff to think about. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
My guest has been Dr. Tracy Erfling. She's a naturopathic physician in Astoria, and we've been talking about the immune system. If next week Dig in the Dirt returns, I will have as a guest Sean Hogan, who is the owner of Sistis Nursery on Savi Island. He's also going to be the keynote speaker at the Spring Garden Seminar of the Clatsop County Master Gardeners in April. I'm Ann Goldine.